The commander of the police escort was one of those beefy, boyish young Rhodesians with impeccable manners and an air of quiet competence which I found most reassuring. He was an assistant inspector with an askari sergeant and five constables under him. His rank and the composition of the escort gave me some indication of the level to which Lurin had applied for cooperation. We had two Land Rovers, both with mounted medium machine guns on the bonnet, and the armament of the rest of the party was impressive, as was to be expected on the borders of a country subjected to unceasing harassment by terrorist infiltrators from the north. "Dr. Kazin," the inspector saluted, and we shook hands. "My name's MacDonald, Alistair MacDonald. May I introduce my men?" They were Matabeles, all of them. The big, moon-faced descendants of Shaka's fighting impis, led here 150 years ago by the renegade general Mizilikazi. They were dressed in camouflage fatigues with soft jungle hats, and they stood to rigid attention as MacDonald led me down the single rank. "This is Sergeant Ndabuka." And when I acknowledged the introduction in fluent Sindabili, the stern military expressions dissolved into huge, flashing smiles. Chai was obviously very ill at ease in this company. He followed on my heels like a puppy. "Did you know, Doctor, that there's a field order still issued to the British South Africa police that hasn't been rescinded?" MacDonald told me, as he looked Chai over with interest. "It's an instruction to shoot all bushmen on sight. This is the first one I've ever seen. Poor little blighters." "Yes. I had heard of that order, which was maintained as a curiosity, but too faithfully reflected the attitude of the last century. The time of the great bushman hunts, when 100 mounted men would band together into a commando to hunt and kill these little yellow pixies as though they were dangerous animals. White and black had hunted them mercilessly. The atrocities committed against them were legion. Shot and speared and worse. In 1869, King Kama had enticed a whole tribe of them to a feast of reconciliation. And while they sat at his board, with their weapons laid aside, his warriors seized them. The king had supervised the subsequent torture personally. The last bushman died on the fourth day. With this history to remember, it was no wonder that Chai stayed within arm's length of me and watched these colossal strangers with frightened Chinese eyes. I explained to MacDonald our approximate destination, pointing out the general area on his map as accurately as I could reckon it from Chai's description, and the inspector looked grave. He picked a shred of sunburnt skin from the tip of his nose before replying. "That's not a very good area, Doctor." And he went off to talk to his men. It was midday before the helicopter came clattering over the treetops from the southeast. Laren jumped from the cabin, lugging his own bag. "Sorry I'm late, Ben. Had to wait for a phone call from New York." MacDonald came forward and touched his cap ring. "Good afternoon, sir." His attitude was deferential. "The Prime Minister asked me to give you his respects, Mr. Stuyvesant, and I am to place myself at your disposal." We left the track before we reached the ranching country near Tete, and we swung away northwards towards the Zambezi. MacDonald was in the leading Land Rover with a driver and a trooper on the machine gun. We followed in the central spot, Lurin driving and another trooper riding shotgun in the passenger seat, Hai and I together in the back. The second police Land Rover took the rear guard with Sergeant Ndkabuka in command. The slow miles ground past as the column wound through forests of Mopani and climbed the low ranges of granite. At any hesitation in our advance, Chai's arm would signal the direction, and we would move forward, jolting and pitching over the rough places or humming swiftly through open glades of brown grass. I realized that Chai was guiding us along the elephant trail, the migratory road that the huge beasts had beaten out from the river to the sanctuary of the Wanky Game Reserve in the south. Skilled trailblazers, they had picked a route that required the minimum effort to negotiate. Always it was the easy gradient, the low pass through the hills, and the river drifts with gentle sloping banks that they chose. We camped beside one of those drifts. The riverbed was dry, choked with polished black boulders that glittered like reptiles in the sunset. There were banks of sugar-white sand, patches of tall reeds, and a pool of slimy green water overhung with the branches of fever trees. Beyond the river, the ground rose steeply in another of those rocky ridges, dotted with marula trees and patches of scrub. However, on this side, the bush was open, offering a clear field of fire around our camp. MacDonald drew the three vehicles into a defensive triangle, and while he placed his sentries, Lurin and I, followed by Hai, went down to the bank of the pool. We sat on the rocks and watched a colony of yellow weaver birds chattering and fluttering around their nests of woven grass that hung from the fever trees over the green water. Lurin gave Hai a cigar, and while we talked, the little bushman's eyes never left our faces, like those of a faithful dog. The talk was fitful, changing from one subject to another, without design. Lurin told me about the hotel project on the islands. He was very certain of its success. "It's one of my really good ones, Ben." And when I thought about his other good ones, the cattle ranches, the diamond mines, the gold, the chrome, and the copper, I knew how big it must be. I touched lightly on his difficulties with Hillary. "My God, Ben, if only they understood that they don't buy you with a marriage certificate." There were three others who had found out the hard way. I hoped that Hillary would not be the fourth. It was almost dark when MacDonald came down the bank. "Excuse me, Mr. Servicent. Could I ask you to come into the perimeter now? I don't like taking unnecessary chances." And with good grace, Lurin flicked the stub of his cigar into the pool and stood up. "This used to be a country where a man could range to the full extent of his fancy. Times are changing, Ben." When we entered the camp, there was coffee brewing on a low screen fire, and while we sipped from the steaming mugs, I saw the precautions MacDonald had taken for our safety, and I realized that his competent looks were not deceiving. He finished his sentry rounds and came to sit with us. "I should have asked you sooner, but do you gentlemen know how to use the FN rifle and the 60 caliber machine gun?" Lurin and I both told him we did. "Good." MacDonald looked out towards the north. "The closer we get to the border, the more chance there is of a clash. There's been a big setup in the terrorist activities recently. Something brewing up there." He poured a mug of coffee and sipped before he asked, "Well, gentlemen, what are your plans for tomorrow? How far are we from our destination?" I looked at Hai. "How far is it to the holes in the rock, my brother?" "We will be there before the sun stands so," indicating noon with one delicate little hand. "My people are camped at the waterhole, near the holes in the rock. We will go there to find them first, for they have long awaited my coming." I stared at him, realizing for the first time the extent of Hai's friendship. Then I turned to Lurin. "Do you realize, Lo, that this little devil has made a trek of 150 miles on foot, merely to tell us something that might give us pleasure?" "What do you mean?" "As soon as he discovered the old workings, he left his tribe and set off to find me." That night, Hai slept between Lurin and me. He still didn't trust the big Matabele troopers one little bit. It was 11 o'clock the following morning when we saw the vultures in the northern sky. MacDonald halted the column and came back to our vehicle. "Something up ahead. Probably only a lion kill, but we'd better not take any chances." Hai slipped off the seat and clambered up onto the roof of the Land Rover. For a minute he watched the distant birds, and then he came down to me. "My people have killed a large animal, perhaps even a buffalo, for the birds are above my camp. There is nothing to fear. Let us go forward." I translated for MacDonald, and he nodded. "Okay, Doctor, but we'll keep our eyes peeled all the same." The bushmen had erected five rude shelters, beside a hole of mud and filthy water. They had merely bent a number of saplings inwards to form the framework, and then thatched it roughly with leaves and grass. There was no smoke, and no sign of the little yellow people, as we drove towards the encampment. Chai was looking puzzled, darting little bird-like glances into the thick bush, and whistling softly through his teeth. The vultures sat in the treetops, all round the camp, and as we approached, there was a sudden commotion from amongst the huts, and 20 or 30 of the big, ugly birds flapped into the air. Chai let out a soft, wailing cry. I didn't understand what had happened. It merely seemed odd that the vultures were on the ground amongst the huts. But Chai had guessed it. He began rocking slowly on the seat, hugging his chest and emitting that low-pitched wail. Donald stopped his Land Rover and got out. He stooped over something on the ground, and then he straightened up and shouted an order. His troopers jumped from the vehicle and spread out their weapons held ready. Lurin parked our Land Rover, and we went to where MacDonald was standing amongst the huts. Chai remained in the back seat, still rocking and wailing. For the Bantu, the Bushman girls are an object of peculiar lust. I don't know why this should be so. Perhaps it's their golden-yellow colour, or it may be their tiny, doll-like bodies. They had raped Chai's women, all of them, even the little immature girls. Then they had bandited them, and left them lying in that pathetically vulnerable attitude of love. Gal and the other two males they'd shot. Bursts of automatic fire had smashed their bodies so that slivers and chips of bone protruded from the mangled flesh. The blood had dried in black splashes and puddles. There were flies everywhere, big green metallic flies that buzzed like hiving bees and came to settle on my lips and eyes. I struck them away angrily. The birds had been at the bodies. That was the truly horrible part of it, the birds. God, said Lorin. Oh, God, why? Why did they do it? It's their style, MacDonald answered. Frelimo, Mau Mau. All of them hit their own people hardest. But why? Repeated Lorin. They've got guns. They want to use them. This is easier than going for white ranches or police posts. Two of the police troopers carried a tarpaulin from one of the Land Rovers. They began wrapping the bodies. I walked back to our vehicle and leaned against the door. Suddenly, I was sick. An acid, bitter flood gushing up my throat, and I retched painfully. When I was finished, I wiped my mouth on my sleeve and looked up to find Chai watching me. He was a man deprived of everything except the breath of life. There was such agony in those dark eyes, such sorrow twisted that mouth, that I felt my own heart breaking for him. "Let us find who has done this thing, Sunbird," he whispered, and he led me into the short grass around the camp. He worked quickly like a gun dog. There were spills of the bright brass cartridge cases scattered on the sandy earth, shoddily manufactured and stamped with Chinese characters, hundreds of them. The gunners had fired with childish gusto, pouring a torrent of bullets into the camp. Their boots had left the characteristic chevron-patterned imprints. There seemed to be hundreds of them, for the earth was churned and the grass flattened. "They came in the night," Chai explained softly. "See, here. Here is where they waited." He pointed to the scuffed places amongst the bushes. "There were many of them." And he showed both his hands with fingers spread 3 times. 30 of them. A big party. "They struck in the dawn. Yesterday at dawn. 32 hours ago. They'd be miles away now," I realized. When we returned to the encampment, the 9 bodies were wrapped in canvas and laid out in a neat little line, like parcels ready for posting. 4 of the troopers were digging a shallow communal grave. Chai went to squat beside the line of the dead. He was silent now, and the silence was more distressing than his despairing wail. Once he leaned forward and timidly touched one of the green canvas-wrapped bundles. How many of these little men had squatted like this in the sun to mourn the massacre of their tribe, I wondered. It is at times such as this that I hate the savage ferocity of this land of ours. I couldn't watch High's grief, and I turned away and went to where Lorin and MacDonald stood, talking quietly together. "It's a big party, Ben," Lorin greeted me as I came up. "High says there are 30 of them," I told him, and he nodded. "Very likely. The inspector feels we should turn back." "And I reckon I agree with him." MacDonald explained. "Should we run into them, they outnumber us heavily, Doctor. These swine are well-trained and armed with the most modern weapons. It's not like a few years ago when they sent in a half-baked rabble. They are really dangerous now, and we are not an offensive patrol. I think we must get out as quickly as possible and call in the helicopters. Once they locate them, the hunter jets will give them a whiff of napalm." "Yes," I agreed. The ancient workings were no longer important in the face of this horror. I looked across to where the troopers were lifting the bundles down into the grave. High stood watching them. When the grave was filled with loose earth, I went across to High and placed an arm around his shoulder. "Come, little brother," I said, and led him to the Land Rover. The column turned and in the same order made its way back into the south. The journey slowly developed into a nightmare of tension and straining nerves. The revving and gear changing that was necessary to negotiate the rough and broken ground broadcast our progress far ahead of us. Every mile there was a location ideal for an ambush, with thick cover pressing in closely on either hand. Our trail was laid clearly, and we must follow it on our return. They would know this and wait for us there. It was possible they carried landmines, and we watched anxiously for disturbed earth in the trail ahead. The strain was on all of us. Lorin drove in grim silence, with an unlit stub of cigar rolling restlessly in the corner of his mouth. The trooper beside him rode with the butt of the machine gun pulled into his shoulder, and occasionally he traversed the heavy weapon experimentally. All our heads moved constantly, swinging slowly from side to side, searching, searching. "Have you noticed there's no sign of game, Ben?" Lorin asked suddenly. He was correct. Since leaving the Bushman encampment, we'd seen none of the wildlife which had enlivened our outward journey, not even a herd of the dainty brown impala. "I don't like it, Lo." "Join the club," Lorin grunted. "In 32 hours, the bastards could have moved miles. They could be anywhere." I fiddled restlessly with the rate of fire selector on the rifle in my lap. MacDonald had insisted on us taking the spare weapons from two of the troopers on the heavy machine gun. I was glad of it now. There was much comfort to be drawn from that hunk of wood and steel. Suddenly the Land Rover ahead of us skidded to a halt, and Lorin slammed on his own brakes and snatched the automatic rifle from the bracket behind him. We sat with our weapons poised, peering into the wilderness of rock and scrub around us, waiting for the sudden shuddering roar of machine guns. The slow seconds passed, and my own pulse drummed in my ears, deafening me. "Sorry," MacDonald called from up front. "False alarm." The engines revved hideously loud in the vast silence of Africa, and we went on. "For Christ's sake, stop fiddling with that bloody thing," Lorin snapped at me with unnecessary violence. I hadn't realized that I'd been clicking the selector of the rifle. "Sorry," I muttered guiltily. The tension was infectious. Lorin's outburst was a symptom of it, but almost immediately he glanced over his shoulder and grinned apologetically. "This is bloody murder." It seemed hours later that we crossed a ridge and went twisting down amongst the trees to the pool in the dry watercourse where we'd camped the previous night. MacDonald signaled a column to a halt on the far bank, and he came back to us. "We'll top up the fuel tanks here, Mr. Stevenson. I'll see to that. Will you take a party down to the pool and refill the water containers?" Lauren went down to the bank with two of the troopers lugging the 5-gallon jerry cans, while I watched MacDonald begin refueling. The gasoline fumes swirled like a mirage in the heat, and the smell was biting in my throat. One of the troopers splashed the liquid in a spurt down the side of the lead vehicle, and MacDonald reprimanded him sharply. "Stay here," I told Chai, "or do not move." And he nodded at me from the back seat of the Land Rover. I left him and followed Lauren down to the edge of the pool. It was a tranquil scene, so typical of Africa. Tall reeds languidly drooping their fluffy heads. Black mud, pocked with the hooves of 1,000 beasts. Water green and thick, with slime bubbling sulkily with marsh gas. The weaver birds hanging upside down below their swinging basket nets. The two troopers were talking quietly as they filled the jerrycans, Lauren standing over them with the automatic rifle. "Another hour's travel. We'll see us in the clear," he remarked as I joined him. He took a cigar from his top pocket and began unwrapping it, without interrupting his search of the surrounding trees and brush. There was a fleck of white on the rocks at the water's edge. It caught my eye, and I glanced at it, and was about to dismiss it as a splash of bird dropping. And then I noticed something else, and I felt the first cool draft of apprehension blow down my spine. Casually, I strolled along the edge of the pool, averting my eyes from the white object until it was at my feet. Then I glanced down, and my breath jammed in my throat. My first impulse was to scream a warning to Lauren and run for the Land Rover. But I controlled the urge and forced myself to look away casually. Despite the racing of my heart and the difficulty I had in breathing, I managed to stoop and pick up a pebble from the water's edge and toss it out into the pool, where it fell with a plop in a widening ring of ripples. Quickly, I glanced down again.